From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new approach to health insurance for people with chronic disease make the important things less costly and the extras more expensive.
It seems intuitive that the things I would beg my patients to do should be the things that are easy for them to access.
Test driving autonomous cars with no human at the wheel. It's coming sooner than you think.
Technology is having a dramatic effect on how people define transportation and what transportation really is and what they need and what they don't need.
The drastic cut in refugees seeking new lives in Michigan.
The fact that the federal administration banned 11 countries, that has a huge impact on our Southeast Michigan office.
And the families from the Caribbean who found temporary homes in Michigan's UP after last fall's hurricane. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 2016, the Refugee Resettlement Agency, Semeritas, helped some 1,400 refugees find new homes, new lives in Michigan. This year, they expect to receive 100. This is a time of big change for refugee resettlement agencies and refugees in Michigan. Semeritas President Vicki Thompson-Sandy is here with us now. Vicki, from 1,400 to only about 100?
Yes, Semeritas is experiencing the contraction of refugees based on the presidential determination of only allowing 45,000 refugees into the United States this fiscal year, and also the fact that the federal administration banned 11 countries. That has a huge impact on our Southeast Michigan office.
Michigan used to get a lot of refugees from Iraq and Syria, didn't it?
That's right. In Southeast Michigan, that's primarily who we resettled, given the population that's already here in Dearborn and the Macomb County area. In our Grand Rapids, West Michigan region, we typically see African groups, Congolese, Burmese from Myanmar was a large group that we resettled in the Battle Creek area.
So they're coming in still, but it's Iraq and Syria where you've particularly seen a huge change?
That's correct.
What has this done as far as affecting your staff levels, your office locations?
Well, it's had a great impact. So in our Southeast Michigan office, in our resettlement program alone, we employed about 20 employees. We're down to 2 employees. We've decreased the numbers in our Ann Arbor office, and we will not resettle any refugees in that office this year. We will try to do that out of Troy if we have refugees resettle. And then in our West Michigan offices, we are in the process of consolidating our Battle Creek office into our Grand Rapids office, and we've reduced employees there too.
So what does that mean for the refugees who rely on Semeritas for support services?
Yeah, it's a challenge for us to try to continue to support the refugees who are already here, who have been resettled and are integrating into community. It's a challenge for us to meet their needs when we do not have the staff that we had prior. However, I would say that the federal government does pass through dollars to states to do ongoing support for refugees. And so we do have other programs, refugee resettlement programs, school impact programs that today are continuing to be funded. So those staff are there to support refugees.
Is this contraction, is this streamlining happening with other refugee resettlement agencies in Michigan?
Yes, it is.
How much of this, Vicki, is perhaps what we might call the normal ebb and flow of refugee resettlement that we've seen things trending up and down through the years?
Yeah, I would say this is not typical. I mean, we have seen this type of response before. I would take us back to 9/11 when our country responded to that event. And then what happened is that the federal administration made some decisions about how they processed refugees being resettled through clearances. So there was a very stringent impact on the clearance process for a refugee. And so we saw the numbers contract greatly for a while. And we've not seen that in refugee resettlement to this extent. And actually, I believe that this presidential determination of 45,000 is the lowest in the history of the United States since the refugee resettlement program was started.
If you and other resettlement agencies are doing what you're doing, you're cutting back and you're streamlining, what happens if things change down the road and we see more refugees coming in?
Sure, then we will have to try to respond, you know, just like any program that has to develop when there is a need. We will assume those same steps. The challenge for us in refugee resettlement is that refugees bring unique needs. They bring the need of their own language. So we have linguistics, we have culture, and so you can't just hire anyone. You have to hire people who have those skills. So that will be the challenge for refugee resettlement organizations, is the ramping up to meet the need, if that need increases, is much more challenging.
Vicki Thompson-Sandy is the president of the refugee resettlement agency, Samaritas. Vicki, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Safe to say most of us have a pretty fair idea just how the auto business works, including that basic fact that the vehicles rolling off those assembly lines are going to be driven by people. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to say, think again. This is not your father's auto industry. Daniel, you point to a couple big developments in recent days showing that the times are changing. Let's start with that news from Germany.
A German federal administrative court ruled to allow cities in Germany to ban diesel-powered vehicles from parts of the city. Now, if you know anything about the German auto industry or the European auto industry, you know that diesel engines have been a very large piece of the fleet, particularly across the range, frankly, whether it was mass market or premium. But in some countries, you could have segments in the premium sectors of 50, 60, 75% of a class or a sector could have been diesel-powered engines. This is a huge development. This has been part of the fabric of the industry for decades. It's part of the revenue and profit models of the likes of Daimler, BMW, Volkswagen, all those companies. And now all of a sudden in the heart of the industry is saying, look, we're going to allow you to start banning these vehicles from your cities because you think pollution is getting worse, and it is. Mm. And I think it wasn't helped, of course, by the diesel scandal from Volkswagen.
Which one is reminded of every time you drive along Updike Road and see those abandoned VWs parked at what used to be the Silverdome parking lot where they're storing, and there's a lot of them that have been turned in.
That's exactly right.
What would be the equivalent of this action here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, as I point out in the column, I think you could think of a situation where American regulators would say to the car company or to communities, you can ban large SUVs and big pickup trucks from your city because they take up too much space, they're too noisy, and they're too dirty. And I think that would be about the rough equivalent. I mean, those are the cash cows of the industry. But I think it really signifies some real sectoral changes. We have grown very accustomed in the traditional markets around the world, Germany being a great example, the United States being another example, of how the industry works. And we know how the industry works, and we will tell you how it works. Well, there's a lot of things that are happening out in the marketplace today that are dramatically changing a lot of those assumptions. And I think, you know, we saw this movie before here in Detroit in the 60s and into the 1970s when all of a sudden the Asian manufacturers, led by a couple of Japanese manufacturers, started to come into this country and everybody laughed at them. And they said, it's never going to change. You know, we just won the war, you know, 25 years earlier. It's not going to change. And we kidded ourselves. And all of a sudden, the whole industry changed. And I think some of that is happening now. It's very competitive. And technology is having a dramatic effect on how people define transportation and what transportation really is and what they need and what they don't need.
And to that point, tell us what's just happened in California.
California regulators have said that they're pulling this, what's called the safety driver, out of autonomous vehicles. So right now, under certain regulations, if you're going to test autonomous vehicles, you have to have someone actually in the car sitting behind the wheel with a foot poised to hit the brake if necessary. I've been in one of those vehicles, and in the case I was in, it was just a very basic drive around an industrial park neighborhood. I don't know that the driver even touched anything. I don't remember, frankly. But that's what the person's there for. But again, I think you really have an indication of how this is changing, and the technology is coming very quickly, and it's not just the tech people that are doing it. Government regulators are trying to take down barriers to facilitate the testing and development of these kinds of vehicles. And if I had a dime for every person who writes me or calls me and says, well, I'm never going to get in one of those cars, I'm never going to put my family in one of those cars, I'm certainly not going to buy one, to which I say, it's not about you. It's not about you in middle America so much. It's about people in places like Shanghai and Guangzhou, where the cities are very crowded, the pollution is bad. In Mumbai, It's people like my daughter who lives in Washington, D.C., and does not own a car and doesn't need a car. It's more of a headache than anything else. Or people in San Francisco or in Manhattan who, again, don't need the vehicle. They just need to be able to get from one place to the other fairly short distances and then walk away.
So when GM's Mary Barra declares the auto industry will be changing more in the next 5 years than it has in the past 50?
I think she's right. And I think these examples are just two indications of why she's right. And frankly, I don't hear people who are in the industry and in leadership positions saying she's wrong. I'm a big believer in pay attention to what people do, not what they say. And a lot of these companies are doing and acting as if this change is real and it's enduring and it's going to continue to come. One of the real big debates about what's happening at Ford Motor Company right now is we can see what's happening at General Motors. We can see how General Motors is behaving very differently than the old GM. The jury is somewhat out on Ford. Is Ford actually going to practice what it preaches? And I think people are expecting that in the next couple of months, they're going to detail that in much greater detail than they have thus far.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Coming up, people from the Caribbean displaced by hurricanes getting their first taste of Michigan.
We had never seen snow before. This was my son's first time, and it definitely was my first time also.
Plus, we talk with the inventor of self-healing concrete. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is certainly not alone in its struggle to repair crumbling roads and bridges. It is a nationwide challenge. The American Society of Civil Engineers has given America's infrastructure a grade of D based on years of underfunding and delayed maintenance. Sound familiar? Victor Lee has been developing a new material that could help make our roads last longer. The University of Michigan civil and environmental engineering professor has invented self-healing concrete. It can bend, and if it cracks, it can repair itself. Here's Lee talking about the average concrete we all know so well.
The main ingredients in concrete material is the binder, which is typically a Portland cement, and it binds together aggregates, which are basically sands and so on. And then there are some other chemical admixtures that makes it work all together.
And the problem when we get all the potholes and the crumbling, kind of take us through what's happening to cause that.
Mm-hmm. Well, fundamentally, concrete is a brittle material. When I say brittle, it really means brittle, like glass, for example. So we are all familiar with glass. It doesn't like to be deformed. If you try to bend a piece of glass, it simply fractures, right? And this is very unlike, for example, a metallic material, which has some ductility, meaning that it's allowed to be deformed into and bend out of shape, for example. You think of a piece of paperclip, for example. You can bend it out of shape, and it will still maintain its whole piece together.
Correct.
That's not the case with glass. And concrete is brittle like glass. So if you try to press on it, bend it, it will fracture. And once cracked, then everything starts to go bad. So for example, once a crack is formed, and usually it can go from very small millimeter size all the way to centimeter size. Mm-hmm. We see that all the time on pavements and sidewalks and so on.
Now more than ever.
Exactly. And once you have such a large crack, water goes through those cracks. In Michigan, we use a lot of road salts and the chloride ions that goes along with the salt also enters the crack. And with oxygen and also carbon dioxide from air, it forms just the perfect environment for the corrosion of steel. And once steel corrodes, it expands. It turns into an iron oxide, expands against the surrounding material, putting more tension into the concrete and causing further cracking. And sometimes we call those spallings. Whole chunks of concrete spall out and expose the corroded reinforcements. So that's the typical kind of deterioration process occurring in concrete with steel inside. Even without steel, concrete simply cracks, crumbles very easily under load because it's brittle.
So brittle. And thus the road problems we're seeing, as we found out, not just in Michigan, but really across the country. So how does your self-healing concrete differ?
Well, it differs in the sense that it controls its cracking and then it mends it. So to explain this, it's easier perhaps for your audience to understand if we have small cuts on our fingers or our hand.
Like a paper cut.
A paper cut, mm-hmm. Yes.
They sting when you get them.
Exactly. So it's kind of damage, mm-hmm. but we don't go to the hospital because we expect it to self-heal. So that's really a marvelous thing of nature. We have the capability of self-healing. Of course, if you do a big cut, mm-hmm. that's a different story. Then you have to go to the hospital. So the inspiration is, how do we maintain our cracks so small that it can reheal itself in concrete material, similar to our skin material? How do we turn that into something like that? And that's where another kind of natural material helps us. And that is the inside of the abalone shell. This is the iridescent colored material, like rainbow, if you look inside the shell of an abalone. You see that there's this colorful layer which is called nacre. And nacre is a wonderful, wonderful material. It's actually fundamentally also brittle material. It's actually made out of calcium carbonate, similar to chalk that we use to write on the blackboards. And these are brittle material, but nature makes it into a ductile material. How does it do that? Well, it turns out inside nacre, if you look at it under the microscope, you see that there are lots of layering of this material. And these layers, some people call it brick layering techniques. So they actually can move and slide over one another if you overly load the material. So nature has this abalone shell, very tough, but because of the interlayering, it slides and deforms and it accommodates that movement very well. And so we took that and we put a lot of interfaces into this bendable concrete. And it's done by using microfibers and coatings on the fibers in such a manner that if you overload this bendable concrete, it will also slide inside. It will cause this very small, minute motions inside that makes it macroscopically look like a metallic material. So it's actually can deform it out of shape.
So it's more it's resilient.
It's very resilient. Yes, that's an excellent word. It's very resilient to overloading, to large loading.
And then how does it heal itself? I'm gathering the fact that it's very resilient means those cracks aren't as big. They're more like the paper cut.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's the whole point. So if you overload a piece of bendable concrete instead of a big fracture like normal concrete, it actually distributes the damage into many, many minute micro cracks similar to the paper cut on our skin. And then because of the very tiny size of these microcracks, it can undergo self-healing with just a very simple chemistry. And the chemistry is the continued hydration of the cement particles that are not yet used inside, and it reacts with the external water or carbon dioxide, even from air. Just those elements can cause healing. It forms a glue, basically, and connects the two sides of the microcracks and basically healed it, just like the healing of paper cuts on our hand.
That is brilliant. Have you been able to test this on a road surface?
To a certain extent, yeah. So the material has been placed on a patch on Curtis Road in Ann Arbor, and it has worked very well. We actually did a side-by-side comparison between the new material and regular repair mortars on the same bridge deck. And obviously, they are exposed to the same kind of harsh environment on that bridge, particularly is heavily trafficked by heavy truckloads carrying aggregates, 11 axle trucks, and of course experiencing severe winter weathers that we have here. That combination is very destructive to normal concrete. But the bendable concrete laid down there as a patch material outlasts the regular repair mortar by many, many years.
I'm sure you've been crunching numbers and kind of projecting. Could you give us an idea? For example, I could see this being fabulously useful for bridge building, and we know that the typical bridge in the United States was built to last about 50 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think, if we saw one day where your self-healing concrete was used instead, how different could the life expectancy be?
I think it's fair to expect, let's say, 100 years, a good number, to a good round number, with very little repair requirements, unlike normal concrete bridges, which require, unfortunately, unexpectedly shorter life than we often design for and requires frequent repairs. So by eliminating frequent repairs, we're going to be saving money in terms of repair cost. We're going to be saving ourselves from traffic jams because of reconstruction events on the roads. Repair cost of our cars when we run into a pothole.
Sure. All of the above, all the things that we're debating in this state.
Exactly.
Well, it certainly is a very, very interesting invention. So what will it take to have the self-healing concrete be used to build roads and bridges in this country?
Well, there is a process in terms of turning research into practice, and we need to go through that process of getting the material into a shape which is commercially available. We are almost at that edge. We need to also transfer this knowledge to practitioners, to designers of roads and bridges, to become familiar with this kind of material, which is very different from normal concrete. So there's that process of getting new technologies and bringing them into practice.
That was University of Michigan Civil and Environmental Engineering Professor Victor Lee speaking with us back in 2015. According to Lee, large-scale testing of the self-healing concrete is happening now in Japan. It's being used in over 1,000 dampers installed on a viaduct for safety enhancement against earthquakes. And Lee stands by his belief that bendable concrete can be very effective in fighting potholes, saving our roads, saving our tires. Now we turn to you. What question do you have about the roads in Michigan? We'll talk to Kirk Steidel, director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, next week. But first, we want your questions. Leave us a voicemail by calling 734-764-7840. Let me give you that number again, 734-764-7840. You can also ask your question at the Stateside page at michiganradio.org or head over to Michigan Radio's Facebook page and leave your question in the comments on the post pinned at the top. And you just might hear your question next week on Stateside. First came Hurricane Irma smashing through the Caribbean last September 6th. 10 days later, more devastation from Hurricane Maria. Lives lost. The damage to homes and businesses immense. Well, there's a little-known story now to be told from Irma and Maria. It concerns the Lac-Vieux des Airs band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. They're in Watersmeet in the Upper Peninsula. The tribe has business ties to the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. And in the aftermath of the hurricanes, it turns out the tribe brought some of their employees and families to Watersmeet. People from the Caribbean getting their very first taste of Michigan. With us now is Shelley Hazen. She is a member of the Lac-Vieux des Airs band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Shelley, hello.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you with us. And we say hello to Vernita Joseph, who joins us from St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And we all wish we were with you, Vernita.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you with us. And Vernita came to the Upper Peninsula after the hurricane. So what led the tribe to decide to bring some of these employees from the Caribbean up to the Upper Peninsula?
Well, obviously, the biggest reason was for business reasons. When the hurricane was devastated, they did not have a place to work, an office to work out of, and they didn't have internet, which is a key piece to them doing their day-to-day jobs. But the other piece is just that is what Lac-Vieux des Airs is known for, is embracing people into the community and helping in the time of need.
How many people did you relocate?
There was a total of 15.
It was 14 from St. Croix, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 3 from Puerto Rico. Actually, 4 from Puerto Rico.
And there were kids and husbands coming along as well, kids and spouses.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Vernita, tell us, how were you affected by the hurricanes?
My home, personally, was not damaged. There was absolutely no damage done to my home, fortunately. But as far as my car and my husband's car, our vehicles got damaged. Not only didn't we have internet service, but the office roof caved in. Our bathrooms, we have 2 bathrooms here in the office. The roof came in, and in the kitchen area, the roof came in. So the office just was not workable.
So you would not have been able to work?
No, not at all. Absolutely not.
So how long did it take you to decide, yes, I will go to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan?
Oh, immediately. Immediately. After I got word from my office manager, I was on board immediately, and we decided that I'm going to take my 10-year-old to tag along, and then my husband would stay behind.
So when did you actually come to Michigan, Vernita?
I came to Michigan last October 7th.
Ooh, you were here for fall.
I sure was. It was beautiful, too. Came in, I saw the fall leaves and everything. It was gorgeous. And then the snow came October 15th, quite early.
I think I know the answer to this question, but I will ask it anyway, Vernita. Had you ever been to Michigan before?
No, never. This was my first time.
What'd you think, and especially your son?
Beautiful. We anticipated it because we had never seen snow before. This was my son's first time, and it definitely was my first time also. So coming into that, anticipating, waiting for it, and to know that it was coming that early, oh, it was beautiful.
Now, Shelley, what did it take for all of you to, you know, line up accommodations for these employees and their families and then clothing and necessities? How did the community respond?
At first, it was kind of overwhelming because it's like, okay, we need to get them here as soon as they're able to get off of the island. But it was wonderful how everybody came together. You know, everything just kind of fell into place. We were able to get them into our local casino resort hotel. We put out a notice to the community and asked for donations for different size clothing, other necessities. We knew that they would not be coming prepared with winter clothing. So it was great how people just came forward and gave in the time of need.
I imagine, Vernita, I don't think snow boots are probably in most stores on St. Croix.
Not at all. Not at all. No.
You know, Shelley, I'm curious what having these visitors from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, what did it mean to the community? What kind of effect did you see?
You know, we work on the phone, we work on Skype or the internet, but I have never met any of these people face to face. So when they came here and you see these wonderful, beautiful people with just beautiful souls, kind of like the people from Lac-Vieux des Airs, it put a whole different spin on everything. for me personally, I enjoyed them day to day. I still miss them to this day.
We miss you too.
It just put a whole different spin, different atmosphere in the office. I don't know how to explain, like, you know, to go from a working relationship to suddenly you have, like, all of these new friends. I mean, we became great friends.
Yeah. Shelley and I, we connected instantly. It was just great putting a face with the voices.
Well, Shelley, have you ever been to St. Croix?
No, but I hope to get there very soon. And I'm hoping that it's not business, that I can maybe take a vacation and, you know, she can show me around and I can be introduced to some of her culture.
Vernita Joseph, Shelley Hazen, thank you so much for sharing this story of new friends between the Caribbean and the Mille Lacs Feu Désert Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians in Watersmeet. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Up next, as Obamacare continues to divide Congress, there's one new idea with bipartisan support, and it could make big changes to our health care system. It's called VBID, Value-Based Insurance Design, and its creator is a U of M physician.
The fact that price has driven how Americans seek health care as opposed to what drives me as a physician, the health of my patients, it seems intuitive that the things I would beg my patients to do should be the things that are easy for them to access.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Here's something rare in healthcare policy in 2018, an idea that could help chronically ill patients and save money for both the patients and ultimately insurers. And it's an idea with bipartisan support. This idea originated at the University of Michigan. It's an insurance concept called VBID, Value-Based Insurance Design. Dr. A. Mark Fendrick is the director of the U of M Center for Value-Based Insurance Design. He's a professor of internal medicine at the medical school, also a professor of health management and policy at the School of Public Health. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
So excited to be here.
You have a background in economics and you are a physician. So you have married these two together with this concept and you gave it the name Value-Based Insurance Design. So what is VBID? How does it work?
Well, as Americans are being asked to pay more for their health care, the good stuff and the bad stuff, we decided that instead of having Americans pay less for the inexpensive things and more for the expensive things, to design an insurance product that actually makes it easy for patients to get the services that make them healthy and maybe a little bit harder for the services that don't make Americans any healthier.
So the important stuff you pay less for, the icing on the cake that is more superfluous, you would – so you're flipping it. You're turning it upside down.
Exactly. It's just that the fact that price has driven how Americans seek health care as opposed to what drives me as a physician, the health of my patients, it seems intuitive that the things I would beg my patients to do should be the things that are easy for them to access.
For instance, what kind of patient might be we talking about and how would it work?
So typically someone with chronic illnesses, which is the majority of our spending in this country, say diabetes mellitus, very common in Michigan. There are recommended services for which I am actually benchmarked on as a clinician, whether patients control their blood sugar and their blood pressure, whether they get their eyes examined. Well, it turns out that there are many health plans that don't cover these services very well. And now, because of the increased cost, my patients tell me that they'd like to do these things, but they just can't afford it, even though they're insured.
Even though they're insured. So with VBID, how would it change?
So a value-based insurance design looks at those things that are well-defined quality metrics, like a diabetic eye exams, and makes it easy for patients to get those services, not only in terms of removing financial barriers, but also allowing things like easier appointments for those services that are deemed to be most critical.
So the patient gets these critical services and ultimately stays healthier. So insurers aren't paying for those expensive hospital stays.
Right. So for many chronic diseases, we have shown that going to your appointments, getting your diagnostic tests, and most importantly, taking your prescribed medications will in fact at least prolong, if not prevent, those expensive emergency room visits and hospitalizations, which are extraordinarily costly, but more important, you know, a great mental wear on individuals and their families.
So there is a key concept on all this involved called clinical nuance. What is that?
So clinical nuance is the basic element of value-based insurance design. It gets to the point that No clinical service is ever always high value or low value. It depends on who gets it, who provides it, and where. So for someone who's been interested, say, in colorectal cancer screening for a very long time, you can imagine something like a colonoscopy could be extraordinarily high value in a patient with a first-degree relative with colon cancer. It's high value for an average 50-year-old like myself, mm-hmm. but it's of no value and actually may be wasteful in people without family history, say, under the age of 40. So we'd like to see a benefit design that actually pays those highest-risk patients or makes it really, really easy to get those folks who will have their money saved by getting screened. No cost for people over 50, but rather difficult for those folks who were motivated by Katie Couric's Today Show colonoscopy who thought it might be valuable to them.
That is fascinating. So what motivated you to come up with this idea?
Well, what happened was, and I'd like to say in the last century, we were seeing that patients were not actually doing the things that we felt were most important to them clinically and realized that the whole insurance benefit design process was primarily a financial tool and not a health-producing tool. And we started to look at those services that were deemed as not only low-lying fruit but fruit below the ground and took a look at as patients were asked to pay more in terms of co-payments and co-insurance and more recently deductibles, we saw there was no differentiation between the services that we felt were most important and those that we're actually trying to eliminate now that we realize that we're wasting billions of dollars on services that don't make Americans any healthier.
So patients are getting socked in the pocket for something that is, as you say, superfluous as much as something that's extremely important.
Right.
So you come up with this idea, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, is the federal agency responsible for managing our government healthcare system, launched a pilot to test this in January 2017. So it's been a year and some change. How's it been going? What have you learned?
Well, we know that patients are very happy to see lower cost for services that they deem to be most valuable. The demo has been launched in 9 plans in 3 states. It's expanded now to 10 states total for 2018. We're waiting to see the news and the elements of the plans for this coming year. But most importantly, we're extraordinarily pleased to see President Trump sign in the Bipartisan Budget Act. A part of that bill had the expansion of the value-based insurance design demonstration to all 50 states.
And with bipartisan support.
Right.
So, you know, on the ground, as it's working, are people staying healthier and paying less?
Well, they are in the VBID demo, but more importantly, I think a lot of people don't realize that one of the most popular aspects of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act actually has some important VBID elements. And that Section 2713 of the ACA, which most people know as the part of the law that removed 100% of the cost sharing, in other words, made free for patients now 80 primary preventive services, such as my colorectal cancer screening and my lipid screening, mm-hmm. your mammograms and pap smears, your kids and your parents' immunizations are now had all cost sharing removed. And this is one of the most popular aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And notably, over 80% of Republicans support the VBID principles in the ACA that remove cost sharing for preventive services. So we built on the preventive services aspects of the ACA and started to incorporate VBID principles of lowering cost sharing for high-value services and providers in the Medicare program where I felt the need was most great.
Now, certainly a lot of contentious and highly partisan debate about health care, but VBID, as we say, has got bipartisan support, yet we know Republicans are still intent on scrapping the Affordable Care Act. The president says he is. Democrats want to keep it and make improvements. So how does this idea fit within the heated politics of what's happening in our nation?
So I like to say that the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is a 900-page law. I had the great honor to help write one half of one page. And the good news is in every repeal and replace discussion that I have been privy to, there has been clear preservation of the VBID elements of the ACA. So most people believe it's an imperfect law as I do. I think there are some really good aspects and some things that need to be changed. But our little half page is one that has been really preserved not only by Democrats and Republicans, but the enormity of the stakeholders that support this more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff principles is really unique in the fact that we have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the country's largest unions. We have the health plans and the pharmaceutical industry that tend not to agree on too many things that have all gotten behind the VBID idea. And most important, we have numerous patient advocates who understand that although millions more people now have health insurance, they're insured but not covered. and the fact that their deductibles and cost sharing do not allow them to get the services that we would really like to see them use more of.
Insurance in name only, in a sense. Now, VBID was piloted through Medicare Advantage plans. For those who have not yet had to think about Medicare for whatever reason, what are those?
So Medicare is basically divided into two types of plans. There's traditional Medicare, which is fee for service. You pick your physicians. They're really not linked in any meaningful way. Many of us believe that care coordination can bring about, most importantly, better patient-centered outcomes and hopefully more efficiencies by having ties to various types of providers and laboratories and other types of services that health plans could put in place, such as free gym memberships and transportation services. So the folks at CMS, which runs Medicare and Medicaid, felt that the best place to implement a coordinated type program like value-based insurance design would be in Medicare Advantage. We wholeheartedly agree with that and hope someday that VBID principles will extend down to traditional Medicare as well.
And then what about, are private insurers looking at VBID?
Well, the good news is the VBID idea is where it is today largely because of some really courageous private and public payers pre-Affordable Care Act 2010. A company called Pitney Bowes in Connecticut, the municipality of Asheville, North Carolina, basically thought the idea of placing high cost barriers in front of things that would make employees healthier was not a good one, and thus the VBID implementation was born. There are now over 1,000 public and private payers who've put some aspects of clinically nuanced value-based insurance design programs in place. These extend from jumbo Fortune 50 companies to companies that only have 50 employees, because the idea, as you've said, is so intuitive, and the fact that we could balance the increased payments on the high-value services by discouraging those services that we don't need anymore to make them fiscally responsible as well.
What do you think has to happen to really make this the commonplace way that people are insured in this country?
Yeah, the mission of the Value-Based Insurance Design Center is that every American have the option to enroll in a VBID plan. So we're very happy to see this happening in Medicare Advantage across 50 states. There's a demonstration now being enrolled in the TRICARE program, which serves our active military and retirees. The area that we're focusing on now is trying to tie VBID principles into these high deductible health plans, particularly those that are health savings account qualified, which the Speaker of the House and the President speak about quite often. The problem with these health savings accounts, which are quite valuable type of ways to save, is they're tied to these high deductible health plans that don't allow VBID principles outside of preventive care services. So we've been working for over a decade to try to get Congress or the Trump administration to change a very tiny guidance to allow plans flexibility to cover more chronic disease services on a pre-deductible basis. Okay. So currently now, a high deductible health plan cannot cover any service that deals with an existing illness, injury, condition. That's over 98% of Medicare spending and over two-thirds of our spending across the state of Michigan. So we're trying to allow these high deductible health plans to cover, say, insulin, to cover a diabetic eye exam, to cover HIV drugs and antidepressant therapy. And the good news about this, Cynthia, is for 10 years I've been talking about changing this guidance in the IRS, and not a single stakeholder has pushed against it. So we were very fortunate to be working on this for a very long time, again in a bipartisan way. The day after the president signed the expansion of the MA VBID demo, there was an introduction of a bipartisan bill to allow flexibility for plans to cover more services on a pre-deductible basis in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. So we're very pleased to see this bipartisan multi-stakeholder support continue to grow and allow VBID principles to be put in plans across the country, whether they be public or private, commercial or Medicare.
So there feels like the tide is building. What's the potential? Where do you see this hope this is going to go?
Well, I think as a clinician, it's very humbling and the greatest profession in the world to practice medicine. The issues that I see facing this country that are greatest is the innovation coming down the pike, which I call Star Wars medicine, is truly amazing but also expensive. And the issues that we have on the delivery side have not kept up with this innovation. So I call that Flintstones delivery. And the way to get our delivery from bedrock to the space age is to understand that we should buy more of the things that make Americans healthier, understand that prices are important in this regard, but we have to pay much more attention to the billions of dollars that we spend now that don't make Americans any healthier. By removing these low-value services, we'll provide headroom for us to spend more on these amazing galactic services that truly can change a life in an extraordinarily meaningful way. But often these come at a very high price.
Dr. A. Mark Fendrick, director of the University of Michigan Center for Value-Based Insurance Design. Sounds like you are building the framework for what could be a real change in the way Americans get health care coverage and get their health care delivered.
It's very exciting to see an idea that was developed here at the University of Michigan play a meaningful but maybe small role on the national health care reform stage.
Thank you so much for being with us, Doctor.
My pleasure.
And now time for another Michigan bookmark, where Michigan authors review Michigan books. Flint native Michael Collins teaches creative and expository writing at New York University and the Hudson Valley Writers Center. He's director of studies at Why There Are Words Press. Collins' latest book of poems is titled Appearances. Writer John Freeman has this review.
Michael Collins' second collection of poems, Appearances, functions as a spiritual guide of sorts for the non-believer. The poems follow Collins' trips to an unnamed harbor park, he writes, where the temporal opens to the depths, and the writer is daily stumbling onto tiny mysteries. Collins' meditative approach to life's mundane rituals stands out among contemporary poetry collections, begging philosophical questions of the reader and making subtle pleas for conservation along the way. In the harbor, the natural and built worlds meet, and Collins revels in his encounters with small creatures like ducks, pigeons, crabs, and fish, as well as fishing boats, children playing baseball, and even garbage clinging to the rocks and mud at low tide. The lines in the poem Essa in Anima, quote, "We are each ourselves at the harbor. Runners run, readers read, children play. I wander within myself, within the world." Offer a purpose for his daily jaunts: to find the self in one's soul among all the outside noise. For Collins, the soul that he's looking for is composed not of primordial stuff, as in many Judeo-Christian conceptions, but of worldly images of the stunning and mundane alike. In the poem Portrait of the Soul, for instance, we encounter the utility of the built world. The harbor's a flurry of work. Juggernaut mowers crop the lawn. Bushes are trimmed. The sand is combed and brushed away from the walkways. A team sweeps and lines the clay courts. Boats bustle with gossip and cleaning. Though Appearances is unique in its meditativeness, there is a quiet ecological argument underpinning Collins' poetry. If these creatures and settings have beauty, they are worth saving. Or, as Collins phrases the concept in the poem Nature, a dragonfly menaces the curious, gatekeeper to this rough, slumbering sanctuary where nature redreams itself within human construction. I look in. I do not trespass. The wisdom in poetic attention is akin to the wisdom in environmental stewardship, Collins argues, and that is to notice without disturbing what lives. This is not to suggest that Collins naively treats nature as some peaceful idol. Beginning with the first poem in the book, Poem for a Predator, Collins grapples with the violence that persists in the natural world. Do you hate me or crave me past sanity? He asks. Either causes the pleasant and polite to wolf down others' lives. There is a brand of violence in soulless politeness, he argues here, and when he writes, "My soul has no use for this human kindness today, wants to gaze through the surface of this water, the overcast sky's mirror." Somewhere in this tender space between sentimentality and bitter observation, Michael Collins' poems find their quiet purpose.
John Freeman publishes poetry under the name Cal Freeman. He's author of the book Brother of Leaving and the chapbook Heard Among the Windbreak. His newest book, Fight Songs, is out now in paperback. You'll find his reviews and others at michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.